Hey, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Karen. And I am so happy to be here and be sober. And this is so clever. I don't know who thought of this, but alcoholics are amazing. What a great... Put the table up and hang the thing. It's, I love it. Did anybody else notice that? No. You know, Chris and I had a lot of similar drinking experiences. You know, that first time, you know, it was wild turkey straight out of the bottle at a slumber party. You guys still have slumber parties? Yeah, I don't know. And sick as a dog, dry heaves, crying jag. The next day, I thought my head was going to fall off. I prayed it would, but I knew I was going to do it again. You know, it was that feeling of fitting in. You know, that feeling of finally being part of a group, because I was so shy as a teenager. You know, it was just painful shyness, especially around guys. I'm like, because I couldn't speak. Until I realized if you took a cigarette and put one on their back, had a conversation going just like that. Yeah? It was amazing. Yeah, and the whole blackout thing. You know, I was a blackout drinker from the beginning, and I used to joke about what great things blackouts were. Because you save so much time in transit. You know, one minute you're there, and the next minute you're there. It was like, wow, this is great. It's like magic. Amazing. Truly amazing. So, my sobriety date is February 7th, 1992. And, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about how, you know, I've been sober 104 years, and in that time I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink or a drug. Honestly, that has not been my experience. You know, I mean, I've been able to string a few days together, but there have been times when it was absolutely necessary to pick up a drink, just to take the edge off. And thank God I've got Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsors, and women and men that love me enough to talk me off the ledge. Because I never have to be alone again. And neither do you. So hang in, because it gets bad, but it gets better, and then it gets bad again, but then it gets better. So it's an e-ticket, you know. It's the ride, and it is all about the ride and the journey. And it's pretty special. So I usually start with a story. Is there anybody here that hasn't heard the Dick on the Bridge story? Okay, then. In that case. Before I lived here, I lived in Las Vegas. Great AA in Las Vegas. If you ever go out there, let me know, because I can tell you where the good meetings are. Because you'll probably need a meeting. But the more the temptation, I think the better the recovery. So that was a great time. And then before that, I was in San Francisco for 10 years. And I actually got sober in Southern California. But in San Francisco, just before I was leaving to go to Las Vegas, I remember I was coming back on a Friday afternoon from Marin County. And as you come through from Marin, there's a tunnel, and on the other side of the tunnel is this incredible panoramic view of the city. If you've ever seen it, just like, I never got tired of that view. You know, it was so breathtaking. But on the very left-hand side of the tunnel, you come out, there's absolutely no shoulder. I mean, there's just no room at all. So it's Friday afternoon, and the traffic's horrible, and we're just kind of, you know, inching along, and I see the car in front of me, next to the car, right there. I mean, there's not this much space between their car and the car that's pulled over. And the hood's up, and, you know, I see the people in front of me, like, kind of looking like that, and I'm thinking, what in the world's going on? And finally, I inch up next to this car, and there's this guy, right? Hood is up. Engine's overheating, and he is standing there with his dick in his hand, like this, right? Peeing on his engine. And I'm this close, and I look over, and, you know, my first thought, right after I thought, I haven't seen one of those in a while, was, I'll bet this is alcohol related, right? Here it is, Friday afternoon. Had a few brewskis, engine overheats, you gotta go, you know? It's like, I'll piss on it, you know? I mean, what else are you gonna do? And I could totally relate to that. I totally understood. Like, just get to that point when it's like, what else is gonna go wrong? I'll piss on it. And the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you guys totally get that too. Right? I could tell that same story at the office, and there'd be people going like, ew. Ew. And I'd be laughing, and they'd be looking at me like, you know, I had two heads. We get each other here. And that truly is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not saying there aren't other ways to get sober. I'm sure there are. But for an alcoholic of my type, I need you to get me. I need to be able to tell that story and have you totally understand what that means. To have total uncontrolled alcoholism. And that's an example of what that is. You know, there's not very many people out there who truly understand pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We get that. You know, because that's typically what it took to get us here. So what I did when I first, I'll tell you, if this helps anybody, I call them my little 3x5 cards. And I keep three of them, like right in the front of my head. Because if they're too far back, if I got to look for them, I'm in trouble. Because I know that the amount of time it takes for me to go from here to here, life as I know it goes away. And that doesn't take very long. So I have to keep these little 3x5 cards so that when my head lies to me, and I have got a head that wants to kill me, it always will. And it will always tell me bullshit like, well, you weren't that bad. Or, well, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. You know, maybe it was just a phase. Or, you know, one in an airplane at 30,000 feet, you know, over a foreign country, that doesn't count. Crazy stuff. So I've got to make real sure that when my head starts to lie to me, and it always will, that I can remember immediately who and what I am. So I pull out those little 3x5 cards, and I keep three of them. For some reason, five's too many, and two's not enough. And I think, you know, Karen, I don't think a normal drinker was arrested 5 times for alcohol and drugs and didn't see a problem. That's the real scary part. Or I don't think a normal drinker spent her wedding night in jail. Well, he had a problem. If he had just kept his mouth shut, spent my whole life blaming everybody else for my trouble. And the last one is like, I don't think a normal drinker was thrown out of the Plaza Hotel in New York City for peeing in the lobby. Hey, piss on it, right? If you gotta go, you gotta go. Diane did it too. It wasn't like in the middle of the lobby. It was like over on the side on this little settee. You know. And it just made for a good story. You know, I didn't see a real problem with that. That's the scary part of my disease. It tells me, oh, that's just a good story, right? That's not really a problem. Diane did it too. And then the whole thing of lower companions, you know. You just keep hanging with people that are just a little worse than me. You know, every time I'd get to one of those, well, that happened, you know, I'd never do that. And once that happened, then I just keep lowering the bar. You know? Just hanging out with people that were a little bit worse than me. Married one, you know, I mean, whatever it took. So I never had to look at me. It was pretty amazing. So that man that I married really did have a problem. And toward the end, if he'd kept his mouth shut, we would not have spent our wedding night in jail. I'm sure of that. But toward the end of that marriage, and I stayed with him almost 7 years, because he had to be punished. And and you know how it is. Sometimes you just have to set a good example for that man who has a problem drinking. But he was drinking a little too much of my vodka. So I just take my vodka and put it in the bedroom. Put it in the shoebox in the bedroom, and I'd come home from work, because why should I be denied a drink because he had a problem? So I'd come home and I'd get my half glass of Diet Coke, walk in the bedroom and fill up the rest of the half, and walk out and set a good example for that alcoholic husband. Now, I am hiding vodka bottles in the bedroom, and I don't see a problem with his behavior. Because he was my problem. It was never me, ever. As long as I could look at somebody else, I never had to look at me. And my experience has been, I can never, ever find the solution if I don't know what the problem is. And as long as you were my problem, there was never a solution. Couldn't possibly be. So one day, Paul walks out and he found a dead soldier in a shoebox, his empty bottle. And he walks out going, "Karen, what the hell is this?" And I lived my life with deny it till the day you die. And if you say anything with enough confidence, they will believe you. So here he is walking out, I mean, with this empty bottle of vodka, and I am outraged. How dare you think that that is my... Now, there's only two of us living in the house, right? So if it's not his bottle, there's a pretty good chance it's probably mine. But I denied it until finally he just gave up. Well, maybe some burglar broke in and left an empty bottle. I don't know. Yeah. But because I knew he was my problem, I knew if I could just divorce his sorry ass and leave Florida. This was in Tampa. This is actually the third time I've lived in Tampa. So I got a transfer with my company, and I went out to Southern California, and that was 1990. I love new decades. You know, there's something about a new decade, clean slate. I don't know why. I still do. You know, there's something about that zero on the end, you know. So I get out to Southern California, and I'll tell you, then my drinking really took off because I didn't have anybody to set a good example for. And I was alone, and if you had my stress, you'd drink too. You know, divorced and moved and new job and new surroundings and didn't know anybody yet. It was just terrible. The stress was just, you know. And my drinking really, really got out of control until I finally met some people who drank like I did. And the great thing about these people was we didn't just sit and drink. We did stuff. You know, we'd go deep sea fishing in Mexico. You know, we'd go on chili cook-offs in Arizona or up in Long Beach, and they were all just 3-day excuses to stay drunk, but we were doing stuff. So I could stay in my denial because we were doing stuff, you know. Chili cook-offs. God almighty, what an excuse. Shooters, chili, all right. Oh. In fact, our chili booth was called Dances with Chilies. Remember Kevin Costner's movie? And we had the little routine. We'd dance and do shooters, and it was insane. But we were doing stuff. And I used ice cubes. And I had all my own teeth. You know, I couldn't be an alcoholic. I just partied hard. And I couldn't see the difference. Because, again, until I know what the problem is, I can't find a solution. And to me, you know, I had no idea that there's no amount of alcohol that I can safely put in my body. That an alcoholic of my type, that there is zero tolerance. So, about 9 months after I was in Southern California, I get popped again. And this is my fifth arrest. But hey, we've been doing stuff. You know, we've been out playing softball all day. And we start drinking about 10 in the morning, and now it's about 7, and I'm on my way home, and just starting to get a little dark, and this old lady pulled out in front of me. She shouldn't have been driving. The old bat. So she pulled out in front of me, and so, of course, I just had to kind of nick her fender a little bit just to show her that she shouldn't have been pulling out in front of me. By this point, my disease had so overtaken my life that the depths of the denial and the heights of arrogance that had become the disease of alcoholism in my life was so bad that I waited for the cops to come so I could tell them it was her fault. Because it was never my fault. It was always your fault. Well, the cops came and didn't take them too long to realize whose fault it was. And once again, taken out of the car, hands behind my back, for the fifth time, I am taken to jail. And I'm so pissed. I could not believe that they didn't know who I was. So, thank God, you know, this was a judge that realized that I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I was sentenced to AA. I came here on a court card in Southern California, and I was so angry. You know, I was a hard partier. And it was so sad that you people didn't know the difference. And I'd have to sit in these stupid meetings, and you were saying just weird stuff. You know, you'd say something like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I'd think, well, then you don't drink like I do. Because it's 4 or 5 before I catch a buzz. I had no idea what you're talking about. Then you'd talk about how grateful you were to be an alcoholic. And I think, oh, hon, this is a cult. No, this is serious, serious cult shit here. And but I saw you laughing, you know? And I saw you laughing about stuff that was just really embarrassing. And I was sitting there so angry. And you talk about how grateful you are, and I'd think, I wonder how grateful you would be if I stuck a pin in your eye. You freaks. You know, what is wrong with you? Laughing and having a good time. But I also saw that your life was getting better. And mine wasn't. Because I was doing everything that an untreated alcoholic does. And I was drinking and driving. And drinking and driving on a suspended license. Awaiting my court date. In fact, I can almost guarantee that anybody right now on the 275 doing the speed limit is driving on a suspended license. Because that's what you do. You learn how to do all that stuff. All the tricks. Head out the window. One eye. Yeah, I mean, just total untreated alcoholism. But I had to sit in these meetings, and I had to listen. Even though it was hard, because you'd get to that point when you'd read about, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, my ears would close because I did not want what you had. Because you had the disease of alcoholism, and the last thing I wanted was to be an alcoholic like my dad. The absolute last thing. But I saw your lives getting better. In fact, I saw people that would crawl in to the rooms so broken, so beaten by this disease. And in a couple weeks, you know, they're getting roses back in their cheeks, and they'd have a couple friends. And then they'd find a little job. And then they had a God in their life, and their lives were changing. And I was seeing miracles before my very eyes. And I could not deny what I was seeing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm always amazed at people who get sober, like before the holidays. You know, I just couldn't even imagine it. Because even though I'd come to that point in my life when I hated the woman I'd become, she was familiar. I knew what a drunken woman looked like, sounded like, and acted like. I had no idea what a sober woman looked like, acted like, or sounded like. And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. The thought of not drinking, even though you guys talked about one day at a time, I knew what you meant. And I couldn't imagine the rest of my life without alcohol or drugs. But thank God, the one day at a time thing really works. Because I know today, on the worst day of my life, all I've got to do is make it to bed without picking up. That's all I ever have to do. So the overwhelming thing of the future and the unknown and, oh my God, how could I possibly? I don't have to. All I've got to do is make it to bed tonight. And I can do that. Like, with your help, I can do that. So I knew I wanted to try this thing. I knew I wanted what you had. I wasn't sure what it was or how you did it, but I knew I wanted to try it. But I couldn't get sober before the holidays. In fact, I couldn't get sober until after Super Bowl. One more kick-ass party, then I'll try this thing. And I remember on that Super Bowl Sunday, because I still didn't know what the problem was. You know, I saw the solution, but I still didn't understand that there's no amount I can put in my body. Because I really believed that being a sober woman meant that I could drink without getting drunk. And I'll tell you, a drunken woman in her 20s, yeah, you're still cute enough. You can get away with a lot of stuff. A drunken woman in her 30s, not so much. And a drunken woman in her 40s is just damn pathetic. And that's where I was. But I didn't know. Didn't know what the problem was. So I went to this Super Bowl party, and I swore to myself I was not going to get drunk. Once I started, lost the power of choice, didn't make it home, ended up on somebody's couch, pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized, once again sick as a dog on that Monday. And then that Tuesday, I was down in Southern California now, in Orange County, and we had to go up to L.A., for a Kings hockey game for work. So, I put myself together and we all go up there for this work event. And I remember I had two big cups of beer. And after the second, it was like water. It was like nothing. And after the second cup, something in my head said, because I couldn't even catch a buzz after two big cups of beer, something in my head said, then why bother? Whoa, where'd that come from? That is not my thinking. Because my thinking is, then have two more. Till you can take the edge off. But this particular night, when I could not even catch a buzz on two huge beers, and my head said, why bother? I knew exactly what it meant in the big book. Because in Southern California, we used to read a lot. We read that part of chapter 5, but we also read a part of chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And always talked about the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is to control and enjoy his drinking. And on Super Bowl Sunday, when I enjoyed it, I could not control it. And on Hockey Tuesday, when I controlled it, I couldn't enjoy it. And I knew to my toes at that second that I was an alcoholic. And I absolutely surrendered. The next day I went to a meeting, sat in that same chair, and you know, all the stuff we usually see on the walls, you know, we got the mottos and we got the traditions. So when I get tired of listening to you guys, I used to just read the walls, right? And I had probably read that first step 100 times. But this night I sat in that chair and read that first step. And I knew that I was absolutely powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. And I asked God, help me. And it wasn't help me and I promise I'll never do this again. Or help me get out of this and I promise I'll do that and that. No, it was just help me with no conditions. And I felt an energy in that room that literally swept over me. And I went home from that meeting. And I did not have to open the cupboard that held that half-gallon jug of vodka. And I cannot tell you how many nights I had come home from work promising myself that I was not going to open the jug of vodka. But before I knew it, I'm standing in front of the refrigerator with a glass full of ice, you know, going, next time, tomorrow, I'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow never came. So for me not to have to open that cupboard with a half-gallon jug of vodka in it was absolutely step two. And that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself and restoring me to sanity. The third step, after that kind of proof, absolute proof that God is working in my life, third step was pretty easy. And I'll tell you, I believe that the hardest thing that you will ever do in Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely knowing and believing that there's nothing you can do that will make God not love you. Nothing you can do. Because the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is perfect, unconditional love. And by perfect, just by definition, that means there's no degrees. There's no more or less. It's perfect. And it's unconditional. I don't have to earn it. God doesn't leave me when I'm bad. I leave God. God doesn't withhold love or love me more when I'm good and less when I'm bad. If it's perfect and unconditional. That's my mother. My mother loves me more when I'm good and less when I'm bad. But not the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've got to believe that. And I came here kind of believing in a God. But trusting in a God is truly the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to always say, you know, I thank God for AA. But now I truly thank AA for God. The God that I have found here is not the God of my religion. And it's absolutely changed my life. So I always tell a quick story about, you know, how do you do that trust thing? You know, there's a guy that's walking along the edge of the mountain. There's a big chasm, a bottomless pit, and he falls off. And he's going, oh, falling down, and he grabs a branch. And it's just about to break, and he's going, is there anybody up there? If there's a God, please help me. And this big voice booms out, my son, I am God. Let go of the branch. The guy goes, is there anybody else up there? Yeah, it's letting go of the branch. You know, it's truly, truly knowing that I'm going to be taken care of. And today, most of the time, I can let go of the branch. And that gives me goosebumps. You know, that's an amazing thing. And then 4 and 5, you just got to do those. There's no doubt about it, you know. 6 and 7, those are so underrated. You know, 6 is the step where I get to decide just how happy I want to be. How willing am I to accept God in my life? And not my will, not my... Because character defects are all about my will and my ego. So how willing am I to be happy? That's what 6 is really about. And 7, that's when I truly understand and not just figure, shit, humility. Oh, well, all right. It's embracing it, wanting it, because it makes me happier than not having humility. Putting God first before everything. And then my decisions get really easy. If I don't know, I don't do anything. And I wait until that intuition or that hunch shows me the direction I'm supposed to go. And I just do the next indicated step. That's all I've got to do. And keep out of the way. Right? And then 8 and 9 are fabulous. You know, I get to make my amends. I get to start a new life. And 10 is the one that just, you know, saves my butt all the time. And the thing about 10 is I've got to do it. I've got to work it. And work it hard. Because I hate making amends to assholes. I am serious. Nothing is worse. But I've got to remember, it doesn't matter what you did. All that matters is how I reacted to it. So if you're 90% wrong and I'm 10% wrong, I still got to clean up that damn 10%. I hate that. But if I do it, believe me, the next time, I'm not going to be so quick to participate in that 10%. If I don't do it, then they just keep piling up and piling up. And I call my little shit chips. And they just keep piling up until finally I can't see over the top anymore. You know? And I can't afford that. Because once I can't see over the top, I can't see you. And if I can't see you, next I'll be picking up a drink. So 10 is real important. And 11 is... this is where I get the power back. Right? I gave it away in step 1. I admitted I was powerless. And in step 11, I asked for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. It doesn't say understand God's will. Just the knowledge of God's will and the power. And that's all I need to know. I don't need to know what Karen needs. I don't need to know what you need. All I need to know is what God's will is in my life. And then I've got the power. Then it's like the wind in my sails. Right? when the, if you've ever been sailing and the wind is really at your back, it's just, and you go fast and you go straight and nothing stops you. And even if the wind isn't perfect and you've got to tack a little bit, wind is still behind you, you know, and you need a little this way, a little that way. You still get there. It might take a little longer, but you're still going to get there. You're still going to be on the path. And then there's all those times that Karen will stand there with the wind in her face with that little handheld fan. Right? Going, come on, we can do it. Come on, let's do it my way. Come on. Doesn't work. And I know that. But boy, I'll still find that little handheld fan and think that my way will be better. I know that's not true. And then 12, you know, 12 is not an option for an alcoholic of my type. In fact, I stalk newcomers. It's my job. So, if there are any newcomers out there, you will not make it to the door before I find you. Because this is truly where I get to give back. You know, I looked at my life and all the really ugly, horrible things that I did that now can help another woman get sober. And without that, I'm not sure I'd be able to stand the life that I led before I got here. But it's just a way to help another alcoholic understand that I understand, because I've been there. So it's a pretty special deal. You know, it's, I mean, we have each other, we have fun. When you were talking about all the things coming up, you can be just as busy as you want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's fun. And I was willing to give up having fun for the rest of my life if it meant I didn't have to live that way anymore. And I came here to find the best deal in the history of the world. And I don't want to give that up. It's way, way too special. So I am grateful to be here. Thank you for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope. And let's hang in there. It's a good deal. Thanks.